house. Water clanks from the tap like a chain. A lifetime since anything has moved here but rats and birds. I see the last inhabitants as a father and son. The father sending the son out to the city with a handshake and a pocket of old pound notes. He might as well be sending him to bring home the time without a watch to carry it. I'm from a town in the Midlands, the Irish Midlands, called Portlaoise, population of about 10,000 people. And I have a relationship with the town and with Dublin, where I now live. I'm interested in the idea, in clocks. Let's not talk about ideas, let's talk about objects. I'm interested in clocks. And so, one of the many clock poems. The time of listening. The time of listening begins. What can we hear tonight? The clock on the bedside table, measuring our revolutions about it. The last cinders folding in the grate. The wind towering in the chimney. And outside in the trees and in the weather vane of the darkened church, holier still in darkness. We hear traffic, bicycles, the tap-tap of a blind man's journey into night and memory. The green postbox is here, the curbstone here. And almost inaudible, countries away, the delight of early morning school children, discovering the sun again, passing it along overhead, waving as it vanishes from sight. One of the inevitable conclusions of having an interest in clocks is that you have to attempt to examine the past and to recreate aspects of it, because everything becomes the past if you're interested in clocks. The observation creates that time. So I start with the basics. My father's from Castlecomer, about 20 miles from my hometown. Castlecomer used to be a mining town until the late 30s. My father was one of 14 children who lived in a very small single-story house in the countryside, just outside Castlecomer. The Castlecomer jukebox. We often travelled to Gary Hinchford Turf, my mining town father and I, kissing the wet road in his lip-red Volkswagen van. The song on his lips was always, "Sing to me, gypsy, beside your caravan." How has it happened that this is his only tune? Outside Kilkenny, in two rooms, eight boys and their six sisters rearranged the contents of a home and grew approximately into each other's clothes. Did they all have just one tune? Something popular in their youth became the soundtrack for their lives. A haiku worth of "Sing to Me, Gypsy," recorded by him in that house with the outside toilet. December, they stood side to side or in a perfect vaudeville arc, smiling, snow and stars outside. And their parents, uncommonly relaxed, crunching home-baked cakes like popcorn, tossed a threepenny bit, giddily, hand to hand, whispered together like teenagers, selecting the Christmas dinner song from their barefoot Castle Comer jukebox. Sound of turning pages here now, just to prove that this is all going out live, or at least was recorded that way. Etc. Yeah. Oh, here's one called The Return of the Castle Comer Jukebox. And even if we listen to ourselves so much, we hear nothing of the world about us. And even if our pockets are always empty and our calendars full of disappointments, there will always be some youngster wiser by our foolishness, with a coin he has kept for just the right time, when the dancing has stopped and a jukebox light is gone out. The house my father grew up in and his family still exists, but has been recently vacated by my uncle Michael, who's built a new farmhouse just across from it, so it'll inevitably become a shed, you know, for farm tools. My uncle Michael was sick a couple of Christmases in succession, and the rumour spread through the family that he was on his way out. And I have to admit, I was writing the composing the obituaries a little bit prematurely. And this is one of them. Strangers buried him. The farm was in his palm, a map complete with fields, the buckets to be scrubbed spotless, all those gates to shut. The brook the bream were found in, known solely to himself, perhaps a dog or two, and the curate from the village. Wheat rippled on his skin, birds built their nests in him, and that first black Morris miner was ditched there, advising hasty retreat to those who salivated over foxes. Strangers buried him, family by credentials, seeing nothing, not even the contour lines of compost heaps printed on his cutlery, as they packed the past in tea chests and argued about the most direct route home. Sticking with the Midlands for a few more minutes, there's a collection of photographs, the Eason collection, taken of mostly Irish rural towns around the turn of the century again. And this photograph is based on a character from a story of mine, and also from, or this poem, and also from some of these photographs. It's called The Immortal. I'm Martin Drennan from Ballydavis, tipping back glasses of Guinness and whiskey in Dinny Joe's, remembering the balls in the town hall where I'd slip in unnoticed to watch and drool woodbine ash from the balcony. And out in the market square, fresh with the smell of pigs, before the Wright brothers changed the dreams of men, long before spluttering airplanes. Those arms of empty hay carts looked like anti-aircraft guns, aligned, jutting into sky, and the spit and polish farmers, always gaunt in monochrome, scrutinized the camera that captured for posterity their endangered species, the Irish between wars. Meanwhile, back in Dublin, friends of mine who also live in city centre flats had until recently, as a next door neighbour, a man of about my age and his daughter of six. I don't know where the girl's mother was, but the pair of them had spent her 6 years travelling around Europe while he worked in odd jobs and tried to get by, and had only recently settled in Dublin and have since disappeared somewhere else again. Now, the notable thing about the young girl was, because she had spent short times in various countries. She'd picked up little bits of language, but had no complete language, even 6-year-old completeness, through which to express herself. A word for clouds. In her world, now 6 years old, there are common objects yet unnamed, unfound in the partial vocabularies of three homes: English, French, Italian. Sometimes at night, the moon disappears. The moon disappears behind a white spot of language. Are we shocked by this more than by the poverty of love given her? This child without clouds in her sky, sans nuage, sans anubi, and what else besides? Try telling the young woman she will become in 6 years' time. Every has a silver lining. Death will soon roll by. Mount Melick is a small town about 8 or 9 miles from Portlaoise. Mount Melick is notable now, as far as I'm concerned, only for the fact that in the square in the town, there's a Christmas tree that's there all year round. It's for all the world like a cocktail umbrella. And it's extended at Christmas time and decorated, and the rest of the time it just sits there, skeletal. This is an emigration poem, this metropolis being one of the destinations of a lot of Midland Irish emigrants. Have you left Mount Melick forever? Old yellow hut at the end of the garden. Jet sprays aerosol foam on the sky. Have you left Mount Melick forever? The convent has me drunk on wine uniforms. Maguire's dog snaps a trap of teeth through their gaudy fence. Have you left Mount Melick forever? The Christmas tree is still up in April. Just a naked spear. I expect to see the shrunken head of Christmas. Are you continually zebra crossing to make the boys in leather jackets grit their teeth, stamp their cigarette butts out and cry, gulping back years of lust and tears? Have you left Mount Melick forever? The fruit street sellers at home have a cant, depending of course on what they're selling, but particular fruit sellers have a cant: apples, peaches, pears, bananas. That was, you know, that's the subtitle of this. It's actually called Jack, and it's two people I knew who were called Jack, and by the miracles of poetry they end up with one poem to share. Jack. His mother was the woman who cried, apples, peaches, pears, bananas, outside the railway station in which she'd never been a passenger. His father was the artist. His spectrum, red, yellow, green, brown, blue, pink and black. Who loved the blues and sometimes played a 12-bar, all the way from stools to velvet, fiddles and old hands cracking spoons, to the between station hiss of a radio when the bars were closed by darkness. Jack's was the first birth in a town under an electric sun. His first memory, the snooker table light hanging low over that operation, those special instruments he was forbidden to touch. His father, a cigarette dead as conversation between his lips. In a waistcoat soiled with grease and chalk dust, for all his sureness of sight, never recognizing his wife's fruits spread across the bays. The unacknowledged or unofficial legislator of Irish politics and social mores, at least in the Republic, has got to be Gay Byrne. He's responsible for the Gay Byrne radio show, which is about 1 hour and 50 minutes, 5 days a week, and also for the Late Late Show, which goes out on a Friday night. The Guru Maguire's journey to the centre of the earth is about somebody's dealings with such a TV personality. It's therefore not libelous. When his movie star pen pal died, old Maguire received an invite to appear on television and reminisce. A taxi came to his home, its door outstretched for a handshake, and it took him to a great fortress where, after a quarter century of celluloid clips, his two-paid host inquired whether anyone might like to relate some personal memory. Maguire was still, eyes averted from the lights in which he saw ghostly the faces of all the greatest Hollywood idols, totally numbed by such inane chat shows. Her calligraphy, he said, was like plant life in repose. During commercials, the car reappeared to take him back to his little street, where his neighbours waited up with tea, flooding the street with their revelry. So, how did it go, Mickey? And is it really a toupee? I know it's cheap. Having been involved in Poetry Ireland, a publishing and poetry organising organisation for 2 years, I used to hate at readings when poets read poems about poetry or about being poets or about not being poets or about writer's block or whatever. But there's something contagious about it. In the cinema of a poem, the poet is not an actor. He is not the script writer, the director, not even an associate producer. He is not the well-fed man who owns the place, nor is he anywhere in the stalls, the gallery, or in the double seats for courting couples up the back. No, he is to be found upstairs in the projector room, surrounded by sandwiches, cigarette ends, perhaps the occasional bottle. Even so, he can't believe his luck. Late afternoons, he leaves the house, strolls down the street, crosses to the side door, and heads upstairs. Every now and then he finds a reel, somewhat tangled, but all he's got to do is show it. Meanwhile, he smokes his cigarettes, carefully unwraps his squashed banana sandwiches, and feels as if he is always in the dark. I worked at one stage kind of part-time, Nixers, in other words, for a local freebie newspaper. And the only interesting thing that ever took place was one day I had the pleasure of being sent to interview an old man in the town called Eddie Boyle, and he was 70 something at the time, but he was old. He was old in the respect that he knew all the folklore of the town. He knew he remembered everything. He had a brilliant memory, and it was like kind of reaching back over the turn of the century and seeing the town from a totally different perspective. Lower Main Street. I remember your room and the table, and your brother hovering about in the background, the knots of knuckles in your fingers, the way you eyed my cassette machine with suspicion. But I do not remember exactly how I came to be close to you in your final years, to coax you back to when you were my age, a boy in a turn-of-the-century Midland town, where newspapers were the post-communion liturgy at the back of church. And in the richness of tea and grain, scents I did not recognize then, nor have I since, we faced each other, young men across a century of change, our town outside your grocery shop, transformed at such a pace that stepping out from your fading world, rich in an obsolete currency, the notes for that article in my hand, only the butcher's greeting made me reel in time as the clocks of his hanged carcasses dripped seconds on the slab behind the glass. I lived in London for a year in 1987 in Brixton. So here's the token London poem, you know, yourself. Concert off Kensington High Street. By 10 o'clock the site was alive. Casey the foreman already chewing on his pencil. A kettle boiled for the first strong teas. And Cookie on the mixer had prepared a wonderful cement that made the men's mouths water. High up in the scaffolding, Big Bill sang the blues, balanced delicately on an old black bucket that doubled as a piano stool. By noon he had finished the wall, tinkling the ivory bricks into place with so passionate a history of Basin Street that Casey made a collection among the crowd in a riddle, directing latecomers from the street with his no-parking megaphone to the less desirable cement bag seats. And I'd just like to finish with a poem called Alternative Histories. What would we do if all the historians were found dead? Their voices silent, their theories illegible, stuffed in their pockets. When I was 12, the only man who knew who built the fence around that field was discovered face down in the barley, his last words lost on crows. And if we know this morning who lives in this or that house, who owns the corner shop with the paper stand, we are unaware of the wind outside, the chimney pots shifting ominously on their perches, the fast cars coming blindly into the bends ahead, driven by historians who have yet to learn our names. Thank you.